Usually when we talk about a professional portfolio, especially in the tech industry, there is this underlying expectation of, well, it's basically a digital filing cabinet.
Right, yeah, a
Yeah.
resume with hyperlinks.
Exactly. You click a project and you see a nice little screenshot, maybe a link to a GitHub repository that hasn't seen a commit in 3 years.
Probably, yeah.
And you just sort of nod, you check the mental boxes and you move on. It's static, it's binary. They know React or they don't. They've
Right.
queried a database or they haven't. But then you step into the world of a developer who treats code not just as a utility, but as a discipline. And suddenly that filing cabinet is just gone. We are looking at a digital landscape today that reads less like a resume and more like a technical thriller.
It completely reframes the entire conversation. I mean, you aren't looking at a list of technologies someone managed to install via NPM. You're looking at the absolute definition of pushing the boundaries of what a web browser is architecturally meant to do.
And that is exactly what we are unpacking today. We are deconstructing what I can only describe as a masterclass in modern full-stack web development. The source material for our deep dive today is the professional portfolio of Ryan Nyberg. He's a developer with over 10 years of experience and more than 40 shipped projects.
Which is a massive output, by the way.
Huge. And for you listening, whether you are a junior developer desperately trying to figure out how to stand out, or you're a senior architect who's just wildly curious about how the absolute bleeding edge of the web is being built behind the scenes, this deep dive is your roadmap.
Yep, absolutely.
We're exploring a core philosophy here called code as craft. So, okay, let's unpack this. When we say code as craft, what are we fundamentally looking at? Because right off the bat, the portfolio hits you with these numbers: over 10 years of experience, 40 plus shipped projects, 20 plus happy clients, and a 100% on-time delivery rate.
Yeah, and what's fascinating here is that those metrics, especially that 100% on-time delivery rate, they're almost mythical in software engineering.
Right. I mean, scope creep is just a given, usually.
Exactly. Anyone who has ever built software knows that scope creep and delayed deployments are basically industry standards. So to establish the baseline, what we are looking at is the intersection where extreme technical automation meets uncompromising professional craft. The real story, the part that matters to you if you actually build software, is how these applications perform under the hood to enable that kind of
The
reliability.
mechanics of it.
Exactly. It's about a relentless, almost obsessive commitment to high-performance engineering. It's not just, did I get the app to load without throwing a red error in the console?
Right.
It's how many milliseconds of latency did we introduce during the TLS handshake? Or how mathematically secure is the data pipeline in the browser's memory? Or even what is the exact sensory frame-by-frame experience of the user while it happens?
Which brings us perfectly into the foundational architecture of this entire portfolio.
Talk
Because when
about.
you look at the self-reported skills here, it is incredibly, almost ruthlessly focused. 95% of the work is in Next.js and React. 90% is in TypeScript, and 88% is Node.js. Now, if you're listening to this right now and you've got 20 different logos on your resume, Vue, Svelte, Angular, Python, Go, Rust, just trying to catch every single algorithmic recruiter filter, you might actually be doing yourself a massive
Oh,
disservice.
100%.
In an industry where developers just love to chase the shiny new object, learning a new framework every weekend just to put it in their Twitter bio, this developer has planted a massive flag in one highly specific ecosystem.
Right. And that deliberate choice to master a specific high-performance ecosystem, rather than being a jack of all trades, it fundamentally changes the day-to-day reality of writing code.
How so?
Well, by focusing 95% of his output on Next.js and specifically looking at the modern app router architecture and React server components that are mentioned across these projects, you completely eliminate the friction of context switching.
Right, because you're not constantly looking up documentation.
Exactly. Think about the cognitive load of modern web development. When you aren't constantly relearning how a new router parses dynamic segments or how a new state management library handles client-side caching, you free up massive amounts of brain power.
That makes a lot of sense.
You can dedicate all of your cognitive load to solving highly complex domain-specific business logic. You achieve absolute impenetrable type safety with TypeScript, and you extract every ounce of performance out of the browser because you know exactly how the V8 engine is going to compile your JavaScript.
It's like a master carpenter who only uses three specific Japanese handsaws.
Yes, great analogy.
Like, you could have a garage full of power tools, but mastering a few specific hand tools gives you those pixel-perfect results. But I do have to push back here a little bit.
Okay, go for it.
Isn't there a massive danger in being too specialized? Like, if you are 95% Next.js, haven't you effectively backed yourself into a corner? If the industry pivots away from React tomorrow, which you know happens all the time in tech, aren't you suddenly a dinosaur with a highly specific, useless skill set?
Yeah, that is a critical point, and it's a fear that drives so much anxiety for developers trying to plan their careers. But it misunderstands what mastering a framework actually entails at this elite level.
Okay. Unpack that for me.
Mastering Next.js isn't about memorizing its specific syntax or its API hooks. It is about mastering the underlying architecture of the distributed web.
The concepts beneath the code.
Exactly. Next.js is essentially a vehicle for deeply understanding server-side rendering, streaming, HTML, edge computing, HTTP cache control headers, and idempotent API design.
Right, all the hard stuff.
Exactly. When you achieve that level of craft, you aren't just making a page that displays text. You're engineering a distributed system. The specific syntax might change. Vercel might rebrand. React might evolve. But the deep architectural knowledge of how a TCP request travels from a user in Berlin to a server in Frankfurt, and how to stream the HTML response back in chunks so the browser paints the screen faster, that knowledge never becomes obsolete.
Okay, that makes total sense. It's like learning the fundamental physics of an internal combustion engine rather than just memorizing the owner's manual for a specific 2015 Honda Civic.
Exactly. You are learning the physics of the web.
And to see exactly what applying those physics looks like in the real world, we have to look at what I consider the absolute crown jewel of this portfolio.
Kansley Intake Suite.
Yes. Because we've talked about Next.js optimizing speed and architecture, but speed is just a convenience until you apply it to a high-stakes, highly regulated industry. That brings me to Kansley Intake Suite. This is an application where architectural decisions literally dictate legal compliance and corporate liability.
Yes. This is where the training wheels come off entirely and we see what high-end engineering actually looks like in practice.
So to set the stage for you listening, Kansley Intake Suite is a bilingual SaaS platform built for law firms that specialize in tax law, tax criminal law, and criminal defense. It operates fully in both Germany and the United States.
Which is the logistical nightmare, by the way.
Totally. It basically digitizes the entire client intake process. From the moment a panicked individual first inquires on the website, maybe they're being audited, maybe they're facing criminal charges, all the way through to generating the internal working documents that the lawyer uses to prep for the case.
Right.
It handles incredibly sensitive, legally privileged data, and the geo-aware routing on this thing is just mind-bending. They are using Vercel Edge headers, specifically ex-Vercel IP country and ex-Vercel IP country region for edge-level IP geolocation.
Let's really break down the mechanics of what that means, because it is an incredible piece of engineering.
Please do.
In traditional web development, if you want to know where a user is located, the browser has to load the page, run some client-side JavaScript, send a request to a third-party geolocation API, wait for that API to cross-reference the IP and send the response back, and then the browser finally redirects the user to the correct localized version of the site.
Right, and you're just staring at a loading spinner the whole time.
Exactly. It introduces massive latency. It introduces layout shift, where the screen flickers. It's terrible UX. But by using Vercel's Edge headers, they achieve a zero round-trip resolution.
Wait, zero round-trip, meaning the server knows where you are before it even says hello back to browser.
Precisely. It's like having a franchise of a massive library in every single zip code. Instead of forcing a user in Munich to send an HTTP request all the way to a central server in Virginia to figure out what language they should see, the request it's an edge node.
Which is just a server physically closer to them, right?
Right. A CDN server sitting physically just a few miles from their house in Germany. The moment the TCP connection is made, that local edge server injects a header into the request that says, hey, this user is in Germany. It resolves the location instantly in the routing layer before a single kilobyte of HTML is ever rendered or sent to the client.
Okay, but wait, I had to challenge this from an architectural standpoint.
Yeah.
Because why go to all this trouble with edge headers and fallback chains instead of just putting a simple drop-down menu that says, click your country?
Because of trust and friction. When someone is looking for a criminal defense lawyer, they are already in a highly stressed state. Every single click, every second of delay, every confusing drop-down menu increases the bounce rate. The zero round-trip approach makes the technology invisible. It anticipates their context so they can focus entirely on getting legal help.
Okay, I get the UX argument, but what about the infrastructure side? By relying entirely on that specific ex-Vercel of country header, Hasn't Nyberg just hard-coupled his entire legal compliance strategy to a single proprietary hosting provider?
Yes, the vendor lock-in risk.
Right, like if Vercel changes their header architecture tomorrow, or if this law firm decides, hey, we need to migrate to AWS or Cloudflare, doesn't this entire application just break? Does this law firm suddenly start violating GDPR because the routing fails?
That is exactly the right architectural pushback. Vendor lock-in is a massive risk. And that is exactly why the application uses a highly sophisticated resolution priority chain.
A priority chain? What does that look like?
It effectively creates an abstraction layer over the infrastructure. The application doesn't blindly trust the edge header. The chain goes like this first. An explicit URL parameter always wins. If someone shares a link that specifically has you'd in the path, that explicitly overrides everything else.
Okay, makes sense.
Second, if there is no explicit parameter, it checks a referrer market or a secure HTTP-only cookie from a previous session.
Right. So if they already made a choice, it remembers.
Exactly. Only if those don't exist, then it falls back to the IP-derived region from the Vercel edge header. And here's the crucial part. If the Vercel header fails or if the user is masking their IP through a corporate VPN, it gracefully falls back to a sensible, legally safe default.
So it's extreme defensive programming.
Yes. Assuming the infrastructure will fail at some point,
right,
and building a net to catch it.
And the stakes here aren't just, you know, showing the wrong currency symbol on an e-commerce site.
No, the stakes are strict legal liability. This dynamic routing instantly adapts the entire legal framework of the application. If you land on the German side, the application is instantly governed by GDPR and DSGVO privacy laws.
Oh, wow. So the actual legal parameters shift.
Instantly. The cookie consent mechanisms, the data retention policies, the way tracking scripts are injected, it all changes at the server level. If you land on a U.S. state, say, California, the system instantly adapts to CCPA-adjacent privacy framing.
And it even adapts the legal phrasing, right?
Yes. The platform automatically adjusts the no-attorney-client relationship disclaimers to match local bar association conventions based on the state. The underlying statutes it references in the UI adapt. A misstep in how a law firm captures data across international borders, or a delay in loading a proper consent banner because of network latency, isn't just a bug in this context. It's a massive, actionable legal liability.
Which makes the next feature of the Kanzlei suite even more impressive and, frankly, a little terrifying if you don't engineer it perfectly.
Yeah.
Yes, we need to talk about the legal AI triage. The application uses Google Gemini to actually parse the client's intake forms, draft internal briefings, and surface possible legal arguments based on the facts provided.
If we connect this to the bigger picture of AI and enterprise software, this is the perfect case study. It demonstrates the profound difference between a flashy AI gimmick, where you just slap an OpenAI API key into a chatbot, and a legally compliant production-ready tool.
Right.
The engineering decisions regarding the compliance guardrails here are the most critical part of the entire architecture.
Because the liability is astronomical. I mean, if an AI chatbot on the firm's website tells a panicked client, hey, looking at your financial records, you're definitely not going to jail for tax fraud. And then they do go to jail, the law firm is instantly sued for malpractice.
Precisely. And that's why the AI in this suite is strictly and technologically constrained for internal use only.
So the client never sees it.
The client never interacts with the LLM at all. The AI operates as an asynchronous background worker. When a client submits their secure intake form, the backend sanitizes the data, strips out certain PII, and constructs a highly specific constrained prompt for the Gemini model.
Wow, so it's scrubbing the data before Gemini even sees it.
Exactly. And here's where the crafts comes in. Every single analysis it generates for the lawyers is hard-coded with immutability at the database level. The portfolio explicitly notes that it flags everything with potenziell argumentationslinien nur zur anwaltlichen Prüfung, which translates to potential lines of argument for attorney review only.
So it's basically screaming at the lawyer, do not copy and paste this into a brief without reading it.
Exactly. But furthermore, from an infrastructure perspective, the use of a fallback model chain is crucial here.
What is that?
Well, if you are a lawyer relying on this tool to prep for a sudden court appearance, you cannot have the system go down because Google's API is having an outage. The architecture implements a try-catch mechanism with timeout thresholds. If the primary Gemini model experiences downtime, or if a safety filter aggressively blocks a specific prompt because it incorrectly flags legal terminology as violating a usage policy, the system automatically catches that failure and routes the prompt to secondary fallback models.
So it guarantees the output.
It ensures the lawyer still gets their briefing without interruption. That is what enterprise reliability actually looks like.
That is just wild. And to top it all off, just to seal the deal on security, there is a companion Electron desktop app for the lawyers, which at first glance I thought, why build a desktop app when you already have this incredible web platform?
Yeah, it seems counterintuitive, right?
Yeah, but then I thought about the environment.
Exactly. It comes down to understanding the physical reality of the end user. Web apps are phenomenal, but lawyers often review highly confidential, hundreds of pages long case files in environments where they might not have or might actively avoid a persistent internet connection.
Think about a courthouse with thick concrete walls.
Or a train journey across Germany.
Right, dead zones everywhere.
Dead zones or simply unsecured public Wi-Fi, where they do not want to risk transmitting unencrypted legal documents. The Electron app solves this.
How does the syncing work then?
It authenticates securely against the web instance when they have a connection, pulls the open cases, and caches them locally on their hard drive, likely using an encrypted local CLite database.
Okay.
They can review, annotate, and work completely offline. Then when they reconnect, it syncs the state back to the server using IPC inter-process communication between the secure main process and the UI renderer.
That is robust.
And crucially, the portfolio notes that it uses notarized and signed builds for macOS and Windows via GitHub Actions.
Meaning Apple and Microsoft mathematically verify the software hasn't been tampered with?
Exactly. If you try to install unsigned software on a law firm's corporate laptop, their enterprise IT department will instantly block it. Building a desktop app isn't just about writing the code. It's about navigating the rigorous deployment and security expectations of enterprise environments.
Okay, so the Kansley suite is incredibly rigid. It is rule-bound. It has to be because the law demands it. But what happens when you take that exact same level of engineering rigor, that same obsession with the underlying architecture, and apply it to something completely different?
Like what?
What happens when you apply it to creativity or education? Because as we keep moving through this portfolio, we see a totally different side of the code as craft philosophy. Let's look at two specific projects here, TS Learn and HandyRep.
Oh, yeah. These two projects are brilliant examples of prioritizing UX and data integrity, but in an entirely different context than the legal world.
Let's start with TS Learn. This is an educational platform designed specifically for learning TypeScript. It has an interactive code editor, real-time feedback, a dynamic curriculum. But the part that absolutely blew my mind is that the graphics and animations on this platform are powered by 3.js and WebGL.
Which is a heavy stack for a learning app.
Yeah. Now, for you listening, learning TypeScript is usually a slog. It's like reading a dense, dry legal contract about abstract data structures. But this developer is using high-end 3D graphics to teach it.
And that is a phenomenal implementation of code as craft. Because to your point, we know who our audience is. If you're listening to this, you likely already know that TypeScript is a strictly logical typing language. It is abstract. It's about enforcing constraints at compile time. It can be incredibly dry to learn. But why use WebGL? Why use high-end 3D graphics?
Right. I mean, the cynical answer is because it looks cool.
It does look cool, but it goes much deeper than aesthetics. It's about leveraging human spatial memory.
Spatial memory, like mapping out a room.
Exactly. When you are trying to understand complex architectural concepts in TypeScript, like how a generic type narrows through a conditional statement, or how an abstract syntax tree in AST is parsed by the compiler, reading text on a screen creates a massive cognitive load. Your brain has to translate abstract symbols into a mental model.
It's exhausting.
It is. But by integrating WebGL and 3DS, you can actually visualize that abstract syntax tree in three-dimensional space. You can visually map how memory references flow or how union types intersect.
Oh, wow. So you literally see the types connecting.
Yes. It engages the user's spatial reasoning. It turns a logical abstraction into a tangible visual pipeline. It reduces cognitive fatigue and massively improves retention because human beings are wired to understand space, not abstract syntax.
That is fascinating. It's taking the hardest part of learning a language, the mental gymnastics, and offloading it to the GPU to render it visually. It makes the learning experience actually joyful.
Precisely.
And then we pivot entirely to HandyRep, which is a personalized phone case e-commerce site. The portfolio highlights a very specific technical stack here. PrismaZod and Radix UI integrated with Stripe for payments.
A very modern, very solid stack.
Now I have to push back a little here because in the tech world, we throw around terms like scalable backend or pixel perfect frontend all the time.
Oh yeah, they're ubiquitous.
They've almost become meaningless buzzwords on resumes. So what does this specific combination PrismaZod Radix actually achieve mechanically for the person sitting on their couch trying to buy a custom phone case?
That is the exact right question to ask. Because to the end user, the tech stack is completely invisible. But the mechanics of that stack dictate their entire emotional experience with the brand. Let's look at the harmony of this specific architecture and explain exactly how it works.
Okay, let's break it down.
Let's start with the front-end Radix UI. Radix provides unstyled, accessible UI primitives. What this means mechanically is that it handles all the invisible ARIA attributes and accessibility tree mapping for screen readers. It ensures that focus management works perfectly.
So if a user is navigating purely via a keyboard or using an assistive screen reader, they don't get trapped in a custom drop-down menu that doesn't understand the escape key.
Exactly. Or on mobile, it ensures that the touch targets for closing a modal don't conflict with the browser's native swipe gestures. It creates a completely predictable, accessible interface.
Okay, so the front door is wide open for everyone. What about the data?
Then you move to the data layer with Zod. Zod isn't just checking if a text box is empty. Zod executes complex schema parsing directly in the browser's memory. Imagine a user submitting a custom design for their phone case, and they type in an international shipping address.
Right.
Zod validates the complex rejects patterns of that specific country's postal code in milliseconds in the client's RAM before a single byte of data is ever sent over the network.
Oh, I love that. It completely eliminates the concept of waiting for the server to say you messed up.
Precisely. It prevents the system from breaking and gives the user immediate localized feedback.
And what about the back end?
Finally, you have Prisma acting as the ORRM, the object relational mapper managing the back end architecture. Prisma provides absolute type safety between the database schema and the TypeScript backend. It manages connection pooling. So when thousands of people are customizing cases during a holiday rush like Black Friday, Prisma optimizes how the server talks to the database, ensuring connections aren't dropped.
It's all about preventing failure points.
Exactly. From the user's perspective, this combination means the site never lags their massive image file uploads flawlessly. Mm-hmm. Their data is mathematically secure, and their Stripe checkout happens without a single glitch. It's an architecture built purely for reliability.
It's incredible how much invisible work goes into making something feel effortless. It's like a swan gliding on a lake, right? Above the surface, it's perfectly smooth, but underneath the feet are just paddling furiously.
That's a great way to put it.
Now, earlier in the legal app, we saw AI used as an assistant, a background worker drafting briefs. But as we keep reading through this portfolio, it reveals an entire suite of applications where AI isn't just a helper off to the side. It is the core engine. It is the entire foundation.
This is where we see a significant paradigm shift in how applications are conceptualized in the modern era. We are moving past the wrapper phase of AI.
Exactly, the wrapper phase, where you just send a prompt and get text back. But the portfolio highlights projects where Gemini 3.0 Pro isn't just a feature, it's the beating heart. We have Find Truth Can We Talk and Life Story AI.
Let's break these down because they're wildly different applications.
Let's start with Find Truth. This is a forensic audit platform. It scores global service providers like massive ISPs, SaaS companies, mobile carriers on their corporate integrity.
Right.
It essentially gives them a score from 0 to 100 based on their contracts and privacy practices, dropping them into a hall of fame or a wall of shame.
Which requires an immense, almost incomprehensible amount of data processing. A team of human lawyers could never manually read, cross-reference, and keep up to date with thousands of pages of constantly shifting corporate privacy policies across hundreds of companies in real time.
It would cost millions of dollars.
Exactly. The AI here is acting as a forensic verification engine. It is parsing incredibly dense legal jargon. And crucially, it isn't just doing sentiment analysis like, is this document happy or sad?
Right.
It is extracting empirical data. It is looking for specific clauses regarding data retention third-party selling arbitration clauses and mapping those against a strict scoring matrix.
And again, using that IP-based location data we talked about earlier to instantly surface the most relevant local businesses to the user. But here's where it gets really interesting for me. The next app, Can We Talk?
Oh yeah, this one is fascinating.
This is a multi-user chat tool that acts as an AI mediator for high-stakes dialogues. It offers real-time fact-checking and emotional tone analysis. Now I have to ask you, are we really at a point socially where we need an AI couples counselor or an AI business mediator sitting in our chat windows monitoring our tone?
This raises a profound question about the evolution of communication and technology.
Yeah.
We are moving away from the era where AI is just a passive chatbot, where you type a prompt and it gives you a recipe for banana bread.
Right.
Can we talk about positions AI as an active structural participant in human-to-human communication.
Okay, give me a tangible example of how this actually plays out in reality, because it sounds a bit dystopian, if I'm being honest.
Let's imagine you are in a Slack channel or a secure corporate messaging app. A major merger is falling apart. Tensions are high, and an executive types out you guys are deliberately hiding the Q4 losses to tank this deal.
Oh, boy.
In a normal app, you hit send, the damage is done, trust is broken, and the negotiation spirals into chaos.
Right.
And can we talk? The AI is actively monitoring the WebSocket stream. It immediately pauses the message before it routes to the other users. It flags the word deliberately as an unprovable emotional escalation. It flags hiding as accusatory.
So it interrupts the flow of data.
Exactly. And it privately prompts the sending executive, suggesting they rephrase it to, I need immediate clarification on the discrepancy in the Q4 loss report.
Oh, wow. So it literally stops you from blowing up your own life in real time.
Exactly. It intercedes. It provides factual context as someone makes an easily disprovable claim about the contract.
Yeah.
It creates a structured, mathematically neutral environment that de-escalates conflict. It acts as a perfectly objective third party that doesn't sleep, doesn't take sides, and doesn't get emotional.
It's the ultimate de-escalator.
It is.
And then completely pivoting again from high-stakes corporate mediation, there's Life Story AI. This project isn't even a web application. It's a native Android app built with Kotlin and Java. It helps users write their autobiographies using AI writing prompts. It tracks characters and timelines. And this is the crazy part. It connects to an internal book printing service so the user can get a physical hardcover copy of their life story.
It perfectly highlights the developer's ability to bridge the digital and physical worlds. The AI is used to solve the blank page problem. It asks the user contextual questions, helps them organize their fragmented memories onto a digital timeline, and tracks narrative consistency.
Which is huge for writing a book.
Totally. But the ultimate output isn't pixels on a screen. It requires integrating the back-end architecture with physical printing press APIs, managing PDF generation bleed margins, CMYK color spaces, and shipping logistics.
It's a full-stack physical deployment, basically.
Exactly. Whether it's physically printing a book, forensically flagging corporate ethics, or mediating human conflict in a chat room, the AI in these applications is deeply fundamentally integrated into a tangible human reality.
Looking at this massive array of tools from edge-level geographic routing for tax lawyers to mapping abstract syntax trees in 3D space for coding students to AI emotional mediators in chat rooms, There is a profound lesson here.
There really is.
Which brings us to the ultimate question of this deep dive. What is the actual career advice hidden in this portfolio? If you are a junior developer or even a mid-level developer feeling stuck, what can you learn from the architecture of these 12 showcase projects?
If you look at the sheer technical complexity of these projects, the advice is actually quite clear and it flies in the face of conventional wisdom.
How so?
Junior developers and the boot camps that train them often fall into the trap of prioritizing quantity over depth. They build 10 different simple to-do list applications in 10 different programming languages just to pad their resume.
The classic to-do app.
Right. But this portfolio demonstrates the immense career-defining value of solving exceptionally hard edge case problems.
Let's look at a prime example from the showcase to illustrate this PDF kit NextJS. This is a progressive web app, a PWA, that offers over 20 different PDF tools. Merging, splitting, watermarking, adding password protection to PDFs. But the massive technical catch, it is entirely zero server.
And we need to emphasize what a phenomenal technical achievement that is.
Tell me why.
Usually, if you want to compress a PDF online or merge two documents, you go to a random website, you upload your highly sensitive tax return to some unknown server, their backend processes it using Python or Java, and you download the result. It is a massive, terrifying privacy risk.
Oh, absolutely. I never trust those sites with anything real.
Right. But PDFKit does all this manipulation entirely client-side. The binary file manipulation happens directly in the RAM of the user's browser.
Meaning the file literally never leaves their laptop. Total absolute privacy. The network tab in the developer tools would show zero outgoing requests containing the file.
Exactly. And to achieve that, a developer needs a profound, intimate grasp of deep browser APIs, specifically the file API blobs and array buffers. You aren't just sending JSON objects around over HTTP. You are using JavaScript to read raw binary data, literally ones and zeros.
That sounds intense.
It is. You are manipulating byte offsets to inject a watermark into a PDF specification entirely in the V8 JavaScript engine. It is incredibly difficult to do this efficiently without blowing past the browser's memory limits and crashing the entire tab.
Right, because PDFs can be massive files.
Huge. When you build something like this, it shows senior architects and engineering managers that you understand the deep raw mechanics of the computing platform rather than just relying on an AWS backend server to do all the heavy lifting for you.
And then there's another project that perfectly illustrates this, BarStartDE. This is another progressive web app, this time built for training bartenders in Germany. It has custom scalable vector artwork, a gamified quiz system, and crucially offline caching via service workers, local storage, and base64 data URLs.
Again, think about the physical context of the user. A bartender trainee is drilling drink recipes in a concrete basement bar in Berlin where there is zero Wi-Fi and absolutely no cellular connection.
It's a total dead zone.
If the application requires an internet connection to fetch the next flashcard from a database, it is completely useless to them.
So the advice here for developers isn't go learn more programming languages. It isn't add another framework to your LinkedIn. It is solve deeper human problems. Build applications that function perfectly when the user is completely offline in a concrete basement.
Exactly.
Dive into the cache API and service workers. Build applications with absolute privacy by design, where the binary data never leaves the local device memory. Write custom SVG illustration specs with math so your UI is infinitely scalable without losing resolution instead of just slapping a massive, unoptimized, rasterized stock image onto a page. That is the fundamental difference between someone who just writes code and a craftsman who engineers solutions.
And this brings us full circle back to the framework discussion we had at the start.
The Next.js stack.
Right. Mastering your primary toolset, planting your flag in an ecosystem like Next.js, is exactly what frees you up to tackle the physical environment of the user. When you aren't struggling to remember how your router works or fighting with your state management library, your mind is free to focus on where and how the app is being used.
You're not fighting the tool, you're building the house.
Beautifully said. You build for the human context. Whether that human is offline in a bar requiring strict binary privacy for a legal document, or needing immediate legal compliance routed securely by their edge IP address in milliseconds.
So what does this all mean? As we wrap up this deep dive into Ryan Nyberg's work, I think it's abundantly clear that this portfolio isn't just a resume. It is a thesis statement.
Completely agree.
It is a declaration on how the modern web should feel. The web should be blindingly fast, leveraging edge nodes to eliminate latency before the user even blinks. It should be fiercely private, keeping data in local memory whenever mathematically possible. It should be beautifully crafted using 3D rendering to make abstract concepts tangible. And it should be deeply functionally intelligent using AI, not as a party trick, but as a structural mediator.
It raises the bar.
The bar for web development has officially been raised. It is no longer enough to simply make things work. We are now in an era where we must make things meticulously well-crafted.
And that leaves us with a fascinating, almost daunting implication to consider as we close out.
Okay, lay it on.
If one individual developer utilizing these modern tools, rigorous discipline, and this code as craft philosophy, can architect distributed systems that automatically mediate human emotional conflict in real time.
Right.
Systems that can forensically audit corporate ethics by reading thousands of pages of legalese. Systems that can dynamically navigate international legal jurisdictions in absolute milliseconds without a server round trip.
It's a lot.
What happens when this level of extreme craft becomes the baseline expectation for every piece of software on Earth? Will we eventually reach a point where we as users become so accustomed to perfection that we simply refuse to interact with software that doesn't adapt to our immediate physical, legal, and emotional context instantly?
It's a wild thought, because right now, finding an application that works this seamlessly, that anticipates your needs this, perfectly feels like uncovering a technical thriller.
Yeah, it's where.
But maybe tomorrow, if an app doesn't read like a thriller, if it doesn't respect our time and our context, we just won't engage with it at all. We will just close the tab.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the tools you use. Keep exploring the architecture beneath the surface, and we'll catch you next time.